Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I'm Laura Bush. I'm your president-elect. Welcome to the final day. We made it. I'd like to make a quick announcement. This water bottle, which looks like it belongs to someone who really wants it, and apparently they came looking for it, was left on a bus. If anyone knows whose water bottle it is, I'm even happy to ship it. It says Team Rubicon Disaster Response, but I don't know who it belongs to. I know it belongs to a man. So if anybody knows the person, please reach out to me. So we're going to do something fun first. I'm going to announce our gamification winners. Alex Epperly, Catherine Saragosa, Skylar Stump. Our winners for the Mel the Mole game are Marley Mirzwa, Carmen Samariba, Nicholas Zelli, Ashley Hoffman. If all the winners would please collect your prizes at the SDPA registration desk before 11 a.m., we'd appreciate it. I think they're trying to pack up. Dr. Robert Kirstner is chairman of the Endowed Harvey Blank Professor in the Dr. Philip Frost Dermatology in the Department of Dermatology and Cutaneous Surgery and Professor of Public Health Sciences at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. He is chief of dermatology at the University of Miami Hospital and Clinics and Jackson Memorial Hospital and directs the University of Miami Hospital Wound Center. Please welcome Dr. Kirstner.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to see everybody up early on a Sunday morning. You're very impressive, and hopefully I can make your next hour worthwhile getting up so early. My interest is in wound healing, and I've titled my talk, or was asked to talk about, healing the unhealable wound. So we're going to kind of go through that over the next 50 minutes or so. Let's see here. This is my town, so welcome to Miami. Hopefully you're enjoying yourselves. I work just probably a couple miles from here at the University of Miami. Among the hospitals that are involved in the University of Miami is the large county hospital from Miami-Dade County, Jackson Memorial Hospital. It started at that little building in the front, and now that little building is a museum, and in the background is the large Jackson Memorial Hospital. The medical center is quite large. In fact, it's one of the largest medical centers in the country. And where I showed you before, that picture of that building and Jackson in the background, that's where the arrow is pointing. The circle is the whole medical campus at the University of Miami. And then if you go to the very top of the screen and you see downtown Miami, that's where we are right now. Then the water, which is Biscayne Bay, Miami Beach, and then the Atlantic Ocean. So that's where you can see where the medical center is. So I'm going to talk about two common chronic wounds, but I'll talk about a lot of other wounds as part of it, this discussion. And the two common chronic wounds that we see most commonly in outpatient wound centers are the diabetic foot ulcer and the venous leg ulcer. And they're important diseases. Why are they important? Because lots of people have them, they're expensive, and there are lots of complications from these wounds. And I'm just going to share a little data to set the stage about what we're talking about. So the first thing is about chronic wounds affect 6 million Americans each year. That's more than psoriasis, for sure, probably twice as much. And they're very expensive. Conservative estimates in direct costs alone, not time from missing work, suggest that the cost is more than $40 billion each year. And they're important. So if you have diabetes and a foot ulcer, you have about a 45% chance of dying over 5 years. And that's higher, meaning a greater 5-year mortality than many cancers, such as prostate, breast, and colon cancer. So these are important. This is an important disease. Here's some of that data showed right here. You see, similar to colon cancer, but more than prostate, breast, and Hodgkin's disease. You could see a diabetic neuropathic foot ulcer has a 45 5% five-year mortality. Now, venous leg ulcers, the most common leg ulcer, diabetic foot ulcers are the most common foot ulcer, has a prevalence of about 2.2 million Americans each year. It goes up or increases with age. So if you look at groups or a Medicare age, it's over 2% of the population has a venous leg ulcer. And people who are younger, people start getting these ulcers in their 40s and 50s, and that it's about 1 in 200 patients have a venous leg ulcer. And they're expensive. If you have two patients who are equal, matched, the cost of taking care of a venous leg ulcer each year is about $6,000 to $7,000 more. If you multiply that 2.2 million times 7,000, you get to the total cost, which is about $15 billion just caring for venous leg ulcers alone. And if you, we talked about people getting more with age, often when they're retired, but if they're still working, they have 50% more time off from work to care for their medical care if you have a venous leg ulcer. The average American takes 2 weeks off a year to seek medical care. A venous leg ulcer patient takes about 3 weeks off a year to take care of their problems. So a need exists. I've been involved in research and publications. This is a publication from just a few years ago where we talked about taking care of these wounds in the New England Journal of Medicine. A few years before that, we published something focusing just on the diabetic foot ulcer, and we created an algorithm that looked like this. And what I've done is I've taken these two algorithms and I've combined it with some other work that we and others have done, and I'm going to share with you kind of my algorithmic approach to dealing with these wounds. So I'm going to take you through a very prescriptive way to think about these. Hopefully you'll find it educational, interesting. So everything starts with the clinical exam. This is critical because you have to make a decision whether this is truly one of those common chronic wounds, a diabetic foot ulcer, a venous leg ulcer, or something else. So does it look like a venous leg ulcer? Does it look like an arterial ulcer? Does it look like a diabetic foot ulcer? If so, and we'll talk about how you know that it is in a little bit, then the first step you do is vascular evaluation, especially arterial evaluation. And then once you do arterial evaluation, then you could go on to standard of care or a trial of treatment. However, if you look at the wound and say something's not right here, this is unusual in some way, shape, or form, we'll talk about what that means. It typically means atypical location, atypical appearance or presentation. That's going to lead you to do a biopsy. And taking a biopsy of a wound, which many people are scared to, oh, you have a wound, you're going to make it bigger. But that's going to be the critical next step. And the biopsy that you take the tissue, and then you're going to send it for both histology and for tissue culture for unusual organisms. Not basic organisms like staph or strep, but unusual organisms like mycobacteria or fungus. And then, based on the biopsy results, you may do a laboratory workup and then a trial of treatment. Now, if you do a trial of treatment and the patient is not responding, then you're going to rethink the whole condition. What did I miss? And it may lead you to re-biopsying or biopsying for the first time if you went down that center arm. So I'm going to take you through this whole algorithm in some detail over the next 40 minutes or so, 50, okay? Now, what is a trial of treatment? Well, for venous leg ulcers, it's compression. For diabetic foot ulcers, it's offloading. For both of those wounds, it's debriding. And very importantly is measuring the wound, because the only way you'll know if it's getting better is if it's getting smaller. And then if it's not getting better, then you're going to move on to adjunctive care, and I'm going to talk about what that means during this presentation. So let's start by going down this arm of the tree, an uncommon wound presentation, because this is where dermatology providers are going to be critical, because nobody knows the funky things that can happen on the skin than everyone in this room. Okay? So this is where they're gonna say, what's going on here? We need your help. So let me just walk you through some of that situation. So the first rule is atypical appearance. Foot ulcers are common, but foot ulcers that come out at you are not common. right? So this is something that's coming out, even though it's ulcerated, this is a squamous cell carcinoma, okay? The second rule is atypical location. And you all are excellent clinicians, and you could tell me a lot about this patient. So when we talk about venous leg ulcers, the leg is from the knee to the foot. This is a thigh ulcer. You don't get venous thigh ulcers. So this is unusual location. But the other thing that you've noticed very quickly is that how old is this person with this leg? This is a young leg, right? All right. And it turns out that it's an atypical location, but it's also an atypical appearance because these kind of little purple nodules. And this is a lymphoma. This is a 13-year-old girl from Honduras who came to see me. And unfortunately, she died from her wound. She died from lymphoma. And this was her presentation. So there are lots of causes of uncommon wounds. Malignancies, genetic diseases, metabolic diseases, infectious diseases. It's the whole spectrum of medicine, and it's the whole spectrum of dermatology, which makes it exceedingly interesting because you see a lot of things in the context of having a wound. And some of the wounds look very similar. You have to avoid the idea that yesterday you saw a patient, today you see a patient who looks similar, so you know the diagnosis. Because the inflammatory things, vasculopathic things, embolic things, infectious things, hematologic things, vasculitic things may look exactly the same or very, very similar. So you can't say, I know what this is. You can say, I have an idea what it is, but all of those things cause tissue death, and the clinical presentation is critical. So that's why when you see these, you have to avoid the desire to make a clinical diagnosis and go down your algorithmic path, which means taking a biopsy. Because if you took a biopsy of each of these wounds, you would find that the clinical pictures has some features that are similar, whether it's vasculitis, pyoderma gangrenosum, calciphylaxis, emboli, atypical fungal infections like chromomycosis, hematologic disorders like sickle cell anemia. But if you biopsy them, the histology would all be different of these, and that's how you make the diagnosis. So you don't have to walk into a room and know every single thing you're looking at, but you know the next step is taking a biopsy for histology and tissue culture for sure. And then in some instances, you might consider other biopsies like for immunofluorescence if you considered autoimmune blistering disease. How do you take a biopsy? Well, you want to take it part of the edge and part of the center, okay? If you just take it from the center, sometimes bacteria that lives in chronic wounds will have some changes in the wound bed. So you want to take a little bit of the edge as well. You can use a scalpel like I'm demonstrating here, or you could do a punch biopsy, but you want to get down into the dermis for sure and maybe to the subcutaneous tissue, and you want to get part of the edge and part of the center. I usually use a scalpel, take a little rectangular biopsy, and then I put it on a glass slide and cut it in half. And I send half for histology and the other half for tissue culture. Okay? And you're looking for things. You're looking for things. Some of them you don't want to miss, like malignancies. Now I'm going to show you this picture, and you're going to say, well, this is not a diabetic foot ulcer or venous leg ulcer. Of course not. Right? But you know that if a patient walked in and had this, you'd do a biopsy. And that's what I want you to think. That just because it's on the leg, if it looks atypical, atypical presentation, atypical location, biopsy, because you don't want to miss that. Here's it. Now, this is on the toe. But what's that present, the atypical presentation? There's blue, brown, tan, black. If I said there's a plaque with black, blue, tan, brown, white areas that's ulcerated, and I asked you to close your eyes, you'd say, okay, well, that could be a melanoma. But somehow it's on the toe, you don't think of it like that, right? So this turns out to be a melanoma. So if you look at that and say, well, that's a little bit funky, doesn't really look just like the common wound, I'm going to take a biopsy. Now, if you looked at that and said, oh, that looks like a toe ulcer from diabetes, remember, if you go down the pathway and do treatment and it doesn't get better, then you're going to take a biopsy. That's your fail-safe, and we'll talk about that in a moment. What about this one? Again, look to the side of the picture and the side of the leg. You see some tan, brown, white areas with an ulcer. Again, this is a melanoma. All right, so you want to say, this looks a little funky. It's on the leg. I don't see a lot of venous changes. I'm going to take a biopsy, and then you'll make the diagnosis. Okay, this is a bad one. Hopefully you won't see this. Unfortunately, this was before Vismodegib, and this patient had this huge growth that they ignored, and this turns out to be basal cell carcinoma. So malignancies can present as wounds. Malignancies can present as wounds, and each wound, each malignancy has to, you certainly want to make a diagnosis and then treat appropriately. This is somebody who had an ulcer on their backside, like this, but they weren't laying on their back, so you might think, well, it's a pressure ulcer or something like that, but this is a young person, wasn't paraplegic, wasn't bedridden in any way, shape, or form. And then look closer, you see that not only is it an ulcer, but there's a kind of a tumor growing out the edge, and then you have this kind of linear eruption going down the leg. And this is an unusual condition. This is a giant ulcerating squamous cell carcinoma arising. That rash is linear porokeratosis. And porokeratosis is similar to actinic keratosis in the idea that it has malignant potential. And in this case, it went bad, and this is the case that we saw, you see, and published it. Okay, there's the squamous cell, and that's the linear porokeratosis going down the leg. Okay, and if you don't know what porokeratosis is, well, as I said, it's a kind of a linear distribution of hyperkeratotic papules and plaques, and it's an abnormal clonal proliferation that has malignant potential. Now, I want to tell you that all of dermatology can present as wounds, all of medicine. So if I was not talking about wounds and I showed you certainly the picture on the left and maybe the picture on the right, you would say, gee whiz, that's an erosion, okay, with a collarette. See, this is autoimmune blistering disease, pemphigus on your left and bullous pemphigoid on the right. And there's a form of bullous pemphigoid that's localized just to the leg. Okay, so it can, we see this not so infrequently, bullous pemphigoid presenting. And if you're really astute a clinician on the picture on your right, the bullous pemphigoid picture, you see that there's a little blister, a bulli, on the edge of that plaque. And you realize that whole plaque is actually a ruptured blister. So in this case, if you said, well, I see a blister, this is where you might get a direct immunofluorescence to confirm the diagnosis of an autoimmune blistering disease. So blistering diseases and malignancies present as wounds. This is someone who has an ulcer on the face, again, atypical location, but it's undermined and inflamed. And whenever you see a lesion that you may think of pyoderma gangrenosum on the face, you always want to think of a vasculitis, especially what used to be called Wegener's, and now it's called polyangiitis with granulomatosis. Pyoderma gangrenosum on the face, you should think of polyangiitis with granulomatosis. And this patient had this ulcer when she was sent to me for a year. And they said, oh, what's going on here? Does she have maybe zoster? But being the astute clinician, I looked at her eye and she couldn't see. She was blind. So it turns out this is a large vessel vasculitis. This is temporal arteritis. Okay? So vasculitides can present as wounds. Now, nobody in this room can make this diagnosis unless you've seen this slide. It would be very impressive. Unless you were Sir William Osler, one of the great diagnosticians of the 19th and earliest 20th century, this is really hard. Because if you were Sir William Osler, you would say, I think that this eschar that's sitting on these wounds is reminiscent of the grayish membrane you see in the back of the mouth with diphtheria. And this turns out to be cutaneous diphtheria, right? So how do you make a diagnosis? You follow the algorithm. Venous leg ulcers don't present like this. You're going to take a biopsy for histology and culture, and that's how you're going to make the diagnosis of this fairly rare condition. Now, the other thing is there's a tendency to look at something and somebody presents with a disease you know. This person has scleroderma, and you say, aha, that's what their ulcer's from, is scleroderma. But I want to tell you a lot of dermatologic conditions can present with wounds with different mechanisms of action, and your treatment might be different. So in this patient, in someone who has known scleroderma with these digital necrotic ulcers, this time it was due to Raynaud's vasoconstriction. So you want a vasodilating agent to help treat this patient. And a very similar patient with scleroderma has these digital ulcerations. These digital ulcerations are due to the antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, which gives microthrombi. So you don't do vasodilators in this case. You do medicines that break up those little clots. Only by taking the biopsy will you see the histology that will direct you to the pathophysiology and the correct treatment. Okay? Again, atypical location. Why is it an atypical location? Because these are young people with these wounds, and you don't get wounds on the face. Okay? So autoimmune diseases, malignancies, infections, inflammatory conditions or vasculitides, and genetic diseases. This is two patients with epidermolysis bullosa, and you could see the little baby on your left. If you look at the top of that leg ulcer, you can see the blisters arising at the very top. That's your clinical clue that this is actually a blistering condition that led to these ulcerations. This is another rare genetic disease. This is a typical location for this uncommon type of ulcer. Okay? So this is someone with progeria or Werner syndrome. And with Werner syndrome, you get cellular senescence. And as the patient ages, and we're talking about people with progeria in their 20s or 30s, the skin kind of tires out. And they often get Achilles ulcers, which is a rare location for ulcers in general. Werner syndrome. This is on someone's buttocks. The initial thought, well, it's on the bottom. Maybe it's a pressure ulcer. Here's a close-up of that picture. And what's interesting is you have islands of epithelium, but you have also, you've gone, in most of the area, you've gone through the epidermis into the dermis, so it's a true ulcer. And it turns out that this ulcer is caused by HSV. Now, if you're really astute, or human herpes virus too, so there's eight human herpes virus, HS1 is HHV1, HSV2, or genital herpes is HHV2. You say, well, isn't the simplex virus a virus that affects keratinocytes? And why would you have a wound down to the dermis if it's an epidermal viral infection? Well, the reason is that in addition to those viral cytopathic changes that you could do a Zank smear and look for under the microscope or do a biopsy, you have a massive amount of inflammation oftentimes. And that inflammation that accompanies the viral infection that's confined to the epidermis causes a breakdown of the basement membrane. And here you see type 4 collagen, and you see a disruption of the basement membrane. The basement membrane is made up of type 4 collagen. You could see that there's breakage and then eventually ulceration into the dermis. Now, I want you to kind of put it all together, and I wanted to show you a very Miami case, right? You know, there was somebody told me that if you had the financial wherewithal to have cosmetic procedures and you lived in Miami, 90% of people in Miami get cosmetic procedures, similar to like L.A. But if you had the financial wherewithal and you lived in Berkeley, California, only 10% get cosmetic procedures. But in Miami, not only do people get cosmetic procedures in doctor's offices or in med spas, but this is actually somebody who went for a cosmetic procedure in a hotel room, okay? And had something injected in their buttocks, and then 2 or 3 weeks later developed kind of red, edematous, inflamed plaque with ulceration. And I think you get a picture of her buttocks here, but let me just kind of give you a side view. You can really see how kind of deep and that ulcer is. All right, so this is an atypical appearance and location. So what are you going to do? You're going to do a biopsy, right? So we did a biopsy, and in the biopsy, we saw what's called, you know, pathologists love naming things after food. So they call this a Swiss cheese appearance. And this is a very, very typical appearance, a Swiss cheese appearance, of something called a paraffinoma. So this is a silicon reaction, okay? So this person had something injected. It was probably silicone. We biopsied it, and we showed that it was a paraffinoma. But remember when I told you to do the biopsy? I told you you're going to take a piece, and you're going to send half for histology and half for tissue culture. So while we got the histology back here, the other went for tissue culture. And in addition to showing this appearance, the patient also grew out atypical mycobacterium. So this person had both a silicon reaction and atypical mycobacterium. So both of those things had to be treated. And only if by following the algorithm would you have gotten to the idea that there were two things going on. And this is a, so the classic or typical mycobacteriums are the one from history, tuberculosis and leprosy. Every other mycobacterium are atypical mycobacterium. And they've a fellow named Runyon put them in a classification system, and you see there's four different groups based on how the organisms respond to light and whether they produce color. There's photochromogens, scotochromogens, non-chromogens, and ones that grow rapidly. And this patient had Mycobacterium chelonier, and you have to treat this with certain antibiotics. Okay. The other inflammatory condition I want to share, because many times people think of it, and pyoderma gangrenosum is one of the diseases that is both over and underdiagnosed. Right? It's both over. The reason is because there's no histologic classic finding of pyoderma gangrenosum, meaning when you send a pathology, you don't get an answer, this is pyoderma gangrenosum. The best you might get is this is consistent with pyoderma gangrenosum. And really, when you biopsy pyoderma gangrenosum, you're looking to exclude all the other things that can look similar. But the classic presentation is it begins as a pustule, and you can see the pustule on the left. If you saw that pustule, you say, okay, this is folliculitis or impetigo or something benign. But then it goes on to evolve into a necrotic ulcers with inflamed, undermined borders. And this is a classic picture of those two presentations on the spectrum of pyoderma gangrenosum. And then as it continues to grow, you kind of heal in the center, and you continue to ulcerate towards the edge. And as it heals in the center, it looks like slaps of a crib. And this is called cribriform scarring or cribriform healing. The borders are also, as I mentioned, inflamed. And because of that, you can get undermined borders. Okay, so inflamed undermined borders with pyoderma gangrenosum. These inflamed undermined borders. What do you mean? Well, you can take a Q-tip and it goes underneath the edge of the edge of the ulcer. So this is undermining in pyoderma gangrenosum. Again, pyoderma gangrenosum needs to be biopsied. So you see this ulcer, it's on the finger. You say, well, certainly this is an atypical or uncommon wound. You're going to take a biopsy. This turned out to be pyoderma gangrenosum. Some people call it different names on the hand, neutrophilic dermatosis of the dorsal hand and things like that. It's in the same spectrum of neutrophilic dermatoses. We'll call it pyoderma gangrenosum for this lecture. But this ulcer that looks very, very similar turns out was biopsied and turns out to be squamous cell carcinoma. So you wouldn't want to miss a squamous cell carcinoma because you say, oh, this is pyoderma gangrenosum. I know what it is. You have to go through that pathway. Now, one of the things with pyoderma gangrenosum is you have to worry about the phenomenon of pathergy. That is, if you wound the skin in pyoderma gangrenosum, the response is excessive inflammation. And you can get a wound or worsen a wound. So on your left, somebody didn't know they had pyoderma gangrenosum, had a breast surgery, and developed this big wound. And you could see the scar on the outside of that wound where the breast surgery was. The person on the right was thought to have a venous leg ulcer, underwent debridement, and then this resulted because of excess inflammation. So you say, well, gee whiz, what if I do a biopsy? Will this make pyoderma gangrenosum worse? If you think it's pyoderma gangrenosum, after you give the anesthetic, you can give a small amount of triamcinolone, like 5 milligrams per cc, and obviate the pathergy response if you're worried about it. And when I've done that, I've never had pathergy occur after the biopsy. About 18 to 20% of patients with pyoderma gangrenosum have pathergy. So it's not everybody, but certainly a fair bit of patients. Now, the thing you should know about pyoderma gangrenosum, it's a serious condition. Why do I say that? Is because of this type of data that looked at patients with pyoderma gangrenosum and said that they were more likely to die. Okay? And in fact, we know patients with rheumatoid arthritis are more likely to die because they have heart disease, they have chronic inflammation. Well, it turns out that patients with pyoderma gangrenosum have the same rate of mortality as patients with rheumatoid arthritis, which is one of the things that's associated with pyoderma gangrenosum, rheumatoid arthritis. Okay, so I took you down that left side of the path to start, that idea that you walk into the room, It looks unusual in location or presentation. Maybe pain is out of control, and you say, wow, this doesn't look as painful as you're saying it is. And you do a biopsy, and you have this whole wealth of things that you could think about. But what about the center part, the most common situations where you walk in and you say, I think it's a typical wound. So the first thing that you want to do is you want to do a vascular evaluation, all right? Why do you do a vascular evaluation? Because if you find out the patient has peripheral vascular disease, this is going to increase the risk of amputation. And if you have vascular disease in the leg, which you're measuring for, it may coexist with vascular disease of the carotids and coronary arteries that may lead to heart attacks and strokes, and then also it increases the risk of death. Okay? So then once you make that diagnosis, you may want to improve the circulation, send them to a vascular specialist. You may not want to squeeze the limb if they have vascular disease. It could cut off the circulation. And of course, you want to send them to somebody who can give them statins or have them help stop smoking or control their diabetes and so forth. So you want to make that. So how do you make a diagnosis or vascular disease? Well, some of the things on physical exam are helpful. Things like abnormal pulses or unilateral cool extremities. But some things you might have been taught to look for have not been validated. Capillary refill, foot discoloration, skin atrophy, and hairless skin have not been validated. So if you see this, it could be a lot of things and not just peripheral vascular disease. So typically, we suggest you need objective testing. One of the most common and simple objective testing is taking the systolic blood pressure in the ankle and comparing it to the arm. The arm is kind of your normal, and if you have vascular disease in the legs, it may be diminished, the systolic blood pressure. We call this an ABI. And it turns out the lower the ABI, the worse the vascular disease. The problem with the ABI, which should be one, is that in certain populations, you get false results. Okay? Who are those populations? Well, the first is diabetics. Diabetics, because they get glycosylation around their blood vessels. You know they get glycosylation because you check the glycosylated hemoglobin, hemoglobin A1C, right? But they also get glycosylation in the blood vessels, and you can constrict the blood vessels, so they had falsely abnormal or falsely normal systolic blood pressure in the legs. They get glycosylation elsewhere. They get glycosylation of the tendon. So if you ever see a diabetic longstanding and say to them, pray with me, and you ask them to put their hands together like this, they can't do it because they have glycosylation of the tendons and they can only put their hands like this. That's called chiroarthropathy or the prayer sign because they got glycosylation. Older people get calcification of their vessels, and you can't constrict the blood vessels because they're calcified as opposed to glycosylated. So you can't do an ABI and get good results in somebody who's elderly or somebody who has diabetes, so you have to do other testing. The testing that's generally done is called the pulse volume recording. Now, I'm not here to make you a vascular specialist, but I'll tell you some simple rules. The first is that usually it's triphasic, and as it goes from triphasic to biphasic to monophasic, it's worse vascular disease. Normally it's high amplitude. When it goes from high amplitude or to low amplitude, it's abnormal disease. So if you looked at this left leg and the right leg of these two peaks, you could see that as you get down to the ankle and feet, the amplitude drops, especially on, your left. Is it left or right? Right. You're right. Okay. So we talked about standard of care. So you said, we're going to test for vascular disease. You're going to send them for a vascular lab to do a pulse volume recording. And now you're ready to institute treatment. All right? So for venous leg ulcers, the standard of care is compression. All right? And let me just tell you a little bit about the pathophysiology in 30 seconds of venous disease. Okay? So I'm going to step away. So right now, assuming that I'm normal, I'm standing here, the pressure in my legs is high because of gravity, all right? As I walk, as I take some steps, my massive calf muscles pump, and the blood returns to the heart, and my pressure goes down, okay? Then I stop, I'm normal, my valves close, okay? The blood refills from the arterial side in an antegrade fashion, and then slowly the pressure goes up over 20 seconds. That's called the venous refill time. That's normal, all right? But if I have some form of venous disease or calf muscle dysfunction, it's possible when I start walking, I won't return the blood as well, all right? So that's happened sometimes. More commonly, the blood returns, but when I stop, my varicosities, my veins are dilated, my valves are scarred, absent, or they just don't close as well because the vein is dilated, and I get both antegrade and retrograde or reflux. So instead of the venous refill time being 20 seconds, it's 10 seconds or 5 seconds or 3 seconds. That's what's called venous hypertension. It's not elevated pressure, but it's sustained ambulatory pressure. During that walk, rest, walk cycle, the pressure in general stays higher. Okay? That's called venous reflux. Now, I talked about maybe not returning the blood as well to the heart. And that happens when somebody has, well, let me just ask all of you, tighten your calf muscle right now. Now do it without moving your ankle. A little tougher. So quickly you know that if you have a fixed ankle, if you have a painful venous leg ulcer sitting on your ankle, if you have arthritis, you can't return the blood as well, okay? And you still have a functional venous leg ulcer. So what we do is we give compression to return the blood, to substitute for that calf muscle pump and return the blood to the heart. This is what should normally happen, but with calf muscle dysfunction, you have varicosities, abnormal veins and valves, and you get retrograde flow, and you get those venous hypertension or sustained ambulatory venous pressures. Now, once you get that, the cells separate. Endothelial cells separate, and things start leaking out of the blood vessels. What leaks out? Well, red cells leak out, and iron breakdown from the red cells stimulates melanin to produce pigmentation. So you get discoloration of the leg from red cells leaking out, and it's a red-brown color because it's a combination of melanin and hemosiderin or red cells. White cells leak out, and you get dermatitis. Fluid leaks out, and you get edema. And when the white cells leak out, they reduce proteases or proteolytic enzymes that break down tissue and cause ulceration. So that pathophysiology that started with that venous hypertension or sustained ambulatory pressures leads to things leaking out of the blood vessels and the clinical manifestations of venous disease. Okay? Diabetic foot ulcers. That was a leg ulcer. Now we're moved on to the diabetic foot ulcer. There are two reasons why patients get diabetic foot ulcers. The first is from neuropathy. Almost everybody with a foot ulcer has neuropathy. You can test this with a 10-gram monofilament, and you test the sensation in their foot. These patients generally have surrounding callus. They may have mild or no pain, and if they do have pain, it's a burning pain because it's a neuropathic pain. It may be deep on the bottom of the foot. And then some patients have an arterial disease, and that's when you get necrotic lesions, typically distally, because the blood vessels are thinner distally, or anteriorly, because there's less reduplication of the arterial circulation on the anterior part of the leg. Or you may have a combination of neuropathic and ischemic ulceration. So you get this combination of things causing the pathophysiology of diabetic foot ulcers. Okay? So you want to check the vascular status we talked about, and then you want to check for neuropathy using this 10-gram monofilament. Basically, if you touch them on the bottom of the foot where the ulcer is and they don't feel it, it's pretty likely they have a neuropathy. There's validated scales of testing in 10 places, but really, if they're neuropathic in the area of the ulcer, that's a good diagnosis. Now, I talked about compression for venous leg ulcers to help return the blood to the heart. For diabetic foot ulcers, we want to offload the foot. And what we want to do is we want to take the peak pressure right where that ulcer is and redistribute it over the foot, okay? Because if you distribute it over a larger area, it reduces the pressure. The same force redistributed over a larger area reduces the pressure. One of the things that diabetics do in addition to a sensory neuropathy, they have abnormal proprioception. So when diabetics walk, they slap their feet. They have high peak pressures because they slap their feet. So you want to fix the ankle with an offloading device so they can't slap their feet. It reduces the peak pressure. But the most important thing when you give somebody an offloading device in a diabetic, what's the most important thing is that they actually wear it, right? This is a non-compliant group of people. 90% of type 2 diabetes, which is because you're overweight and you don't exercise, and they get complications of their diabetes. They haven't seen caregivers, and they don't take care of their diabetes. They get complications. And now you're going to tell this non-compliant group of people, hey, I'm going to put you in this special shoe. Wear it. And in studies that put a pedometer on a patient's waist and then hit a pedometer in their offloading device, it turns out that only one of four steps that a patient with a diabetic foot ulcer takes is with their offloading device. Now, they don't take a step, take off it, and then walk three steps and put it back on. What happens is they get home and think they're safe, and they take off the offloading device and walk around, okay? And that's a problem. So, and it turns out the more they wear it, the better they do. And we published this, wearing their offloading device helps them heal their diabetic foot ulcer. So what do? Well, we ensure that they wear it. And one way we ensure that they wear it is a total contact cast, okay? And there's good data that if you put someone in a total contact cast, they'll do better. Who here knows how to cast? None of us do, right? None of us do. So what we do is we take a removable walker and then we put $1,000 worth of Coban around it, okay? So you lock them in. You can also put plaster around the cast, but that's a little bit. So you want to lock them into the offloading device. And when you lock them in, this is called the instant total contact cast. And just by putting that Coban around that removable walker, the healing rate improves with these patients because they can't remove the walker. They don't want to. I mean, they could, but you know they'll come back and they won't have that around. Right? So the healing rates improve. The survival of the wound is diminished. The wound heals. Next thing is debridement. Okay? And the goal of debridement is to remove necrotic debris in the wounds, unresponsive cells. The longer a wound has been there, the less responsive the cells in the wound are. So they're less responsive to growth factors. You want to reduce the bioburden and the associated inflammation and proteases. But I want to tell you that it's not just the center of the wound you want to debride. You want to debride the edge as well. And I'll show you data in a moment to show that the edge of the wound is abnormal. So when you debride, this is the debridement I perform in this to get the healthy cells. And let me tell you what I'm talking about. So this is an acute wound. You do a biopsy, do surgery. As it heals, has a lot of growth factors and cytokines, and you have a migrating tongue of epithelium. But in a chronic wound, you have a hyperproliferative, non-migratory edge. It almost looks like cancer. The cells don't migrate. And Mariana Tomic, pictured here as one of the scientists in our department, has found that there are certain factors in the edge of that chronic wound, c-MYC and nuclear as opposed to cytoplasmic expression of beta-catenin, that prevent the wound from migrating and healing. In fact, if you take migrating cells in culture, make them overexpress c-MYC, they stop migrating. And if the presence or absence of that c-MYC or beta-catenin predicts whether a wound is going to heal or not. Now, the issue is that right at the edge of the wound, where you have an elevated c-MYC drives the loss of epidermal stem cells. So if you stain for epidermal stem cells right at the edge, there's no epidermal stem cells to migrate across the wound. But if you go a little farther and debride the edge, location B we call it, then you have lots of epidermal stem cells, even more than you see in normal skin. So the idea is to debride to get to that normal skin that has the capability of healing. Now, this is looking at beta-catenin, which it should be found in the cytoplasm. When it's found in the nucleus, the cell, the keratinocyte, looks all green. When it's found in the cytoplasm, where it should be, the cytoplasm is green, but the nucleus is clear. And you could see, if you had a molecular or microscopic eye, you could see that on the left, the cells are completely full of green. On the right, They're open in the center. So that's where you wanted to breed if you had a special eye. And we're studying this, this concept of seeing whether or not we can, if you get to the good healthy cells, wounds will heal. And we think that they will. So you debride the wound bed, you debride the wound edge, and then you measure the change in the wound size. Lots of ways to do it. Length turn width, you could use magical cameras. The idea is to measure the wound size. So many times people will in their charts, patient comes with a wound, no size, and then they come back. How do you know if they're better? You know? So you have to measure the wound. And the idea is if they're doing great, if the wound is getting smaller, keep going. But if they're not doing better, then you have to add something on. All right? So the idea is you want to do your vascular evaluation, start your treatment, measure the wound size, but if they're not getting better, you want to rethink and say, okay, what did I miss? Did I miss anything? And here's an example of somebody who had this leg ulcer. I thought maybe it was a venous leg ulcer. I put them in compression. They didn't get better. So I did a biopsy, came back squamous cell carcinoma. I'm like, really? Where? Wow. I live in Florida. Maybe the lab made a mistake. So I said, let's have some fun. I'm going to take 15 biopsies and map out the squamous cell carcinoma just for fun. It was all squamous cell carcinoma. Okay? So the idea is if somebody's failing to respond to conventional therapy, rethink and say, what am I missing? In this case, it was a squamous cell carcinoma. Now, when you measure a wound, for diabetic foot ulcers, it's real simple. Real simple. If it's not 50% smaller in 4 weeks, it's not getting better. For venous leg ulcers, it's a little harder because they can be larger in different sizes. You know, so for an average venous ulcer, 30 or 40% smaller. But if it's circumferential, you have to use common sense because no circumferential venous leg ulcer is going to be 50% smaller in 4 weeks, or 40 or 30. So you have to use some common sense. But for diabetic foot ulcers, the magic number is 50%. If it's not getting better, then you move to adjunctive care. All right? So what's supported by randomized controlled trials? Lots of products out there. Every week somebody's coming in your office saying, hey, slap, you know, Boutros butt paste on your patients, which is actually a product. But what's driven by randomized controlled trials? Well, artificial skin, also called skin substitutes, also called cell and tissue-based products. There are cellular constructs. The bilayered cellular construct, Apligraf, works and is proof for venous leg ulcers and diabetic foot ulcers, randomized controlled trial. There's a dermal construct called Dermagraft, approved for diabetic foot ulcers. There's acellular products listed here for diabetic foot ulcers, and in one case, the porcine product or Oasis is approved for venous leg ulcers. There's placental products, the Grafix and Epifix, and their devices, negative pressure wound therapy and hyperbaric oxygen. There are also growth factors. The only one approved by the FDA is Regranex for diabetic foot ulcers. But GM-CSF, granulocyte macrophage colony stimulating factor, does have some evidence for venous leg ulcers, although it's not approved for that indication. And then there's some oral agents that I'll talk about in a moment. Okay? This is a paper that we wrote, and I created this chart, evidence-based therapies for diabetic foot ulcers. Here are the growth factors, platelet releasate, and platelet-derived growth factors. Here are the cellular constructs, the human skin equivalent or Apligraf, and the dermal skin substitute or Dermagraft. These are the placental products, the acellular constructs. These are the placental products, and these are the others. And you see that this has both the data with regard to healed, time to closure, whether it's FDA approved or cleared, how good the studies were, and how many studies they had, and whether they have real-world data. And you could see, this is all the products that have evidence for diabetic foot ulcers, but you could, even within this, there's quality differences and additional RCT differences. This is one of the products that has the most data. This is Apligraf, the bilayered cellular construct. They take cells from a foreskin. They take the fibroblasts and put them in a bovine type 1 collagen matrix. Let it grow for a few days, put keratinocytes on top of it, grow it for 3 weeks in a lab, and then send it to you to apply it. On the left is, these are two venous leg ulcers. The one on the left is meshed, and you could see that you come back and the skin's not there because it doesn't stay, it doesn't take, it's not the patient's own skin. But those growth factors and cytokines change the wound itself, make the wound behave differently, change the type of inflammation, and it goes on to heal, even though the construct doesn't stay around. On the other picture on your right is a venous leg ulcer. Here it's fenestrated, not meshed, but the same type of thing. You see stimulation of healing and eventual complete healing. So this has good data for venous leg ulcers and diabetic foot ulcers. In the last few minutes, I want to tell you about some oral agents you can do. This is the two oral agents that have the best data, aspirin and pentoxifilene. Both are more than one randomized controlled trial to help venous leg ulcers. You add this to the compression. Two small studies for aspirin, and the studies were done in Europe. So our aspirin dose is 324, but in Europe it's 300. And what they found, that it improved ulcer healing, and if you kept the patient on it, it delayed time to recurrence. Now, if patients tolerate aspirin, it's a reasonable thing to do. Okay, so if they can take a full dose aspirin, not a baby aspirin, it's something very easy, safe to do for patients with venous leg ulcers. Pentoxifilene is probably the best studied medication. There have been 12 different trials, nearly 1,000 patients enrolled, and they found that 70% improvement in healing when you added pentoxifilene to compression for venous leg ulcers. And it turns out that if you can get patients to take a high dose, 800 milligrams three times a day, the approved dose for claudication, which is its indication, is 400 milligrams three times a day. But if you can get to higher doses, it seems to be even better. For some reason, pentoxifilene has become somewhat difficult to obtain and it's become costly. It's not really clear. Very, very safe. The major side effect, or the only side effect, is in some patients, it upsets their stomach. So I usually start low and then increase it as they can tolerate it up to that 800 milligrams three times a day. New on the scene is statins. And the story with statins are very interesting. It turns out that they did a study and they first showed that if patients took lipid-lowering agents, it reduced the likelihood of having an amputation if you were diabetic. And then they showed if you took statins, it was even better than other lipid-lowering agents. Well, that's not so, you know, hard to understand because statins reduce cholesterol. Cholesterol is important in peripheral vascular disease development. So if you don't have peripheral vascular disease, you're probably not going to have as many amputations. Okay, no big deal. Until one group of cardiologists and cardiothoracic surgeons say, wait a second, maybe it's not the statins' effect on peripheral vascular disease, but maybe it has a pro-healing effect. Because it has, without showing you all the data, it's anti-inflammatory and immunomodulatory. It increases epithelialization and angiogenesis. So that led to this study of venous leg ulcers that was a relatively small study, about 66 patients, where they compared simvastatin versus a placebo plus standard of care for 10 weeks. And they dichotomized the wounds based on the wound size. The smaller wounds, less than 5 centimeters, had faster healing. And the larger wounds had better healing. So statins may have a benefit. It turns out statins are also good for other wound types. This is for digital ulcers in patients with scleroderma. This was a 2-to-1 randomization of atorvastatin, meaning of the 84 patients, 56 received atorvastatin. And what they found was that the primary outcome was a third fewer new digital ulcers. But they also found that the disability improvement index improved, Raynaud's improved, the ulcers healed better, and pain improved when patients got statins. So statins are pretty ubiquitous, but if a patient isn't on it, you can add it on and have a beneficial effect for your chronic wounds. New on the horizon is beta blockers, okay? And Rivka Izeroff from UC Davis has done a lot of work that showed that if you stimulated the beta adrenergic receptors, and the way you stimulate them is with catecholamines or epinephrine, high stress states stimulate the beta adrenergic receptor, and if you do that, it impairs healing. On the other hand, if you block the binding of the beta adrenergic receptors, aka beta blockers, or it helps to speed the healing through reversing the pathway I showed you, changing the electrical field, or upregulating MAP kinase. And that data that Rivka Izeroff developed in the lab was then taken to burn patients who had high stress states. They had a big burns, and they were given systemic beta blockers, propranolol versus placebo, and both superficial and deep wounds healed faster. The size of the burn that needed to be grafted was smaller, and patients got out of the hospital faster and it was less expensive. So then I saw this patient about 10 years ago or so. She came to me. She was a young woman, and when she was 18, she had a baby and had a rare complication, postpartum cardiomyopathy that required a heart transplant. She did well for 18 years, but then rejected it, and had a second heart transplant, and it was complicated by a lung infection, empyema. She needed a chest tube to drain the empyema, and she was left with this non-healing wound. Now, I don't think you really get a sense of what I'm looking at when I saw her. So this is her. I still don't think you get a sense of what I'm talking about. So this is her wound. Let's see if I can. And I ask her to take a deep breath. Take a deep breath, please. With each deep breath, the base of the wound goes in. So if she got an infection on this, go right to her lungs. We tried this, we tried that. She didn't want surgery. She had been through so much. So what do? We looked in the literature. We reminded ourselves of the beta adrenergic receptor story. So I decided to say, hey, I can give, we gave systemic beta blockers, but she developed hyperactive airway disease, so we had to stop those. So then I said, what about topical beta blockers? We use them for in the eyes all the time. So I took topical timolol to the eyes and placed it into that wound. This is when she presented. We started using it. The wound started getting better, 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 and she went on to heal. And this was the first reported case of a topical beta blocker and a beta blocker for a chronic wound. It then went on to other studies. And then she came back, and finally, after she healed a couple years, she said, all right, I'll finally have some surgery. And this is how she ended up. So she did very, very well. Okay? But that idea of me using the topical timolol 10 years ago on this patient led to this randomized controlled trial for venous leg ulcers that showed that topical beta blockers sped the healing of venous leg ulcers. So it's a very rewarding story in a relatively short period of time, going from a single case report all the way to the end to data now that's higher quality data as opposed to a single report. Okay. So I want to stop here and just remind you of what I told you so far, or told you today. The first is, when you see a patient with a wound, the first question you're asking, is this a common chronic wound? Is this a venous leg ulcer? Is it an arterial ulcer? Is it a diabetic foot ulcer? I told you some of the clinical characteristics and why these diabetic foot ulcers and venous leg ulcers occur. And for all of them, you're going to do arterial vascular evaluation. You're going to send them to the vascular lab because it's important for the wound and it's important for their general health, and it's going to influence how you're going to treat them. And once you find out their vascular status and if it's okay, you can institute a trial of treatment, okay? Now, if you walk in and it doesn't look like a common chronic wound, that's where your money is. That's where all you guys are going to be invaluable. If somebody presents with an atypical location, atypical appearance, an atypical presentation, you're going to do a biopsy, and then the results of that biopsy might lead you to some laboratory evaluation and then subsequent treatment. But if the patient does not get better with a trial of treatment, then you're going to rethink the situation. It may have you re-biopsy the wound again or biopsy for the first time. And remember, the treatment we're talking about is compression for venous leg ulcers, reversing that venous hypertension, offloading the diabetic foot ulcer, debriding both the wound center and the wound edge, measuring the change in wound size, because if they're not getting better, you want to move on to adjunctive therapy that's evidence-based, and that will give you the best chance of helping your patients. So hopefully providing evidence-based care will help you care for your patients with wounds, and I want to thank you very much for your attention. I don't know if this clock is correct, but it looks like we have 2 minutes if there's any time for any questions from the audience. All right, well, it was a pleasure spending the morning with you. Enjoy the rest of your time in Miami.
There are some questions actually up on the screen right in front of you.
Oh, okay.
And I'll pop some more.
Okay, thank you. High tech. All right, so the question is, why rectangular biopsy and not a lips? And do you close the site? So you want to get part of the edge and part of the center. How you do that probably is not critical. As long as you get that, The reason why I do a rectangular biopsy is then I take that tissue, I put it on a glass slide and cut it in half and send half for histology and half for tissue culture. If you did an ellipse by the part that's at the corner of the lips is on either side, won't be that much tissue for the pathologist or for the tissue culture. You could do an ellipse, there's nothing wrong with it, but you want to get enough tissue. In general, I do not close those biopsies. But good data suggests if you take a biopsy, it heals in beyond the original borders, much like a debridement would heal in beyond the original borders. Are you interested, any interesting topicals you've experimented with, such as Medihoney and things like that? So by far, everything I told you today is much more important than any topical you're going to use. That doesn't mean topicals can't be beneficial, but there's a saying in wound healing, it's not what you put on the wound, it's what you take off. Taking off meaning pressure of the foot, taking off meaning the venous hypertension, and taking off meaning debridement. But certainly Medihoney is very attractive to patients. Patients like natural products, and there's some data suggest Medihoney may have beneficial effects. Other data suggested that it may not be beneficial, but certainly there's very little harm. In general, when you choose a topical in chronic wounds, you want to have a topical that absorbs the exudate, because the fluid that comes off of a chronic wound is bad. Fluid off an acute wound is good. If you capture fluid from a surgical site and put it on cells in culture, they grow great, those cells. If you take fluid from a chronic wound and put it in cells in culture, it inhibits their growth. So while you want to create a moist environment, you don't want a chronic wound to be sitting in that fluid. So you want dressings that will absorb the drainage, so it's not sitting in that fluid that's detrimental. The ideal size of a punch biopsy, the ideal size, I generally don't use punch biopsies for the edge because they're small. Even 4-millimeter punches are hard to get the edge. But if you can do it, it's fine. Probably 4 is the smallest that you can use. You can use 6. I generally just use a scalpel. They're numb. You cut them, put some pressure. So that's what. Next question, any others? No. All right, thank you very much for your attention. Pleasure.